I recently, for some reason, came across or thought of the wonderful story of Alice in Wonderland. And I don't think I've ever read it, or I don't think it's ever been told to me as a kid,
but I've always sort of known about it as part of our cultural heritage, if I may say so, although Lewis Carroll was British. And so I looked it up on the internet, and I was really stunned. It's Zen. It's just Zen from beginning to end. It's Zen, you know. I was just like, wow, this is Alice in Wonderland. And then I've been sort of fixated on that. I tend to do that, I see her journey as not one of enlightenment, unfortunately, but it's definitely an initiation journey. So an initiation is a preparation for enlightenment. That's the way I understand it. And so, you know, it's a necessary journey. A lot of us don't get to make it, but she did it, and did it in spades. And we are left with wonderful Zen instructions if you look at them from that perspective. And speaking of perspective, what if I showed you this? And I said, isn't this fantastic? Isn't this really, really great, you know? And you probably, you know, yeah, well, what is it, you know? And then I'd say, oh, I'm sorry. What I wanted to show you was this. You see? You see the difference in perspective? We look at it like this, and it just makes no sense at all. You know, it's worthless. More than that, kind of colorful, but still, you know. And if we look at it like this, it's a pagoda. You know, a five-story pagoda. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Yeah, a five-story pagoda. That's what happened to Alice after she went through Wonderland. Is she had a change in perspective. She started seeing the world in a different way, as we all do if we go through a journey of initiation. And this, it's not just nice to be able to see the world the way it is. It's necessary. And unfortunately, not many people, I dare say, including me, see the world exactly as it is. But thank God for Buddhism. So, this up here. Oh, yeah. I have to show you this. I've had this picture of a young monk for maybe 20 years, at least 20 years. Mm-hmm. I never took this picture. I've never been to Thailand. And I saw this picture, and I was so struck with the spontaneous joy. Fantastic. So I hung on to it for 20 years. It's very, very incredible for me to hang on to anything for 20 years. So I hung on to it, and so I wanted you to show it to you today, and obviously I've had it in this frame for 20 years, but I just came across yesterday, as a matter of fact, a quotation from the Dalai Lama. He says, "It is vital that when educating our children's brains, we do not neglect to educate our It is vital that when educating our children's brains, we do not neglect to educate their hearts." And I wonder, when he said that, if he realized what a revolutionary statement that is in this society. You know, educate children's hearts? Can they use computers better when they have their hearts educated? I don't know, because we don't educate children's hearts generally. So I'm going to hang this around my neck, because there's no nails in the wall here. And, otherwise, I would, of course, put it on the wall. But I really like this so much, I decided I'd do a hote. This is called doing a hote. I'd do a hote today, hang it around my neck. This is a 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah, this is a four-story pagoda. That's a five-story pagoda there. So, Peter, this is my mother. So that's all I want to say about her. Okay. Alice in Wonderland. First quotation. Begin at the beginning. That's pretty reasonable, isn't it? It's incredible. Begin at the beginning. What an idea. We don't do that. Begin at the beginning and go till you come to the end. We don't do that either, generally speaking. Yeah. Then stop. From Alice in Wonderland, I couldn't believe
how authentic that is. And Lewis Carroll probably never heard of Zen or Buddhism or anything like that, but you don't have to. And then I want to show you one of the mistakes that we make.
This cartoon here of a stone wheel. One of these guys, these are cavemen, two cavemen here. I mean, from the way they're dressed and so forth. And two cavemen, and they have a stone wheel that's rolling down the hill. And one of these guys has just invented this wheel, and it's about to mash both of these guys. And so the guy who invented it says to the next guy, "My next big project is brakes." Well, so after computers, what is our next big project? Does anybody know? I wouldn't like to think about it myself. So we have a tendency to have this belief in progress, that progress is always good, always positive, and always necessary. And we're in a mess now. We're in a mess like we've never seen before. And I don't know how progress is going to get us out of this, if anything is going to get us out. Here's a painting from the Middle Ages, about the 15th century, I believe, Hieronymus Bosch. Well, they had really weird names back then. I could never pronounce them. And from the first time I saw this painting, I was so struck. And it, you know, what he, this is the Tower of Babel. This is when God, you know, everybody was quarreling and so on. Or no, they had pride and they were building this tower, you know, computer of its day. They were building this tower into heaven. And God says, no, you can't go there. And so he made them all, struck them all with different languages. And of course, then they messed up the whole thing. But when I saw this, oh, this is progress. This is civilization. You know? This is, the whole thing is, you know, as soon as we prop something up, something else falls down. It's almost the law of God. It really is. There has to be balance at all times. And the balance must happen. And when we go out of balance, then who knows what's going to happen to bring it back into balance. So Hote has a very serious side, which I think most people don't really appreciate. And I didn't when I first encountered Hote. And all these little guys up here are various versions of Hote. But I would like to begin at the beginning, well beyond when Hote existed, if he ever did exist. And the beginning for all of us, even today, is this. You've probably seen pictures of her. This is called ordinarily the Venus of Willendorf. Willendorf is a city in central Austria, where I used to live for a while. I didn't live in Willendorf, but I lived in Austria for a while. And a friend of mine in Austria gave me this statuette. And this is estimated, it was found by archaeologists, amazingly enough, a little over 100 years ago. And amazingly enough, this is an exact replica of the statuette. To the millimeter, I'm sure, knowing the Austrians as I do. This is estimated to be at least 25,000 years old. 25,000 years old, and possibly 30. And if this had been found in isolation, or just one of these, or maybe a couple of these, you know, we could sort of, okay, well, there was one or two creative guys back then. And by the way, I'm convinced that a man made this, not women. Why should women make they are this? Why should they make it? So we could assume that there are one or two creative men back then. This statuette, or similar ones, have been found all over Europe. Okay? All over Europe. You know? So there was some kind of group consciousness or group awareness going on even 25,000 years ago. It's astounding. You know? And What is also so astounding is there's no face. God, today women, I mean, they're so pressured into being beautiful, you know, from the instant they're born until the day they die. And here, you know, there is no, not even any face, because the face didn't matter particularly back then, 25,000 years ago, if we can sort of imagine that far back. What mattered was, could the woman have babies? Was the woman, you know, fertile? You know, because back then, even back then, they understood that babies come out of women. They didn't understand that man had to have a hand in it. That was a mystery back then. Back then, it was mysterious. Every so often, a woman would start to get big, and eventually she had a baby. You know, everybody was astounded. Well, it is astounding. It is absolutely astounding. But they didn't have the appreciation of the necessity of men. And so I am convinced, and I realize this is very, very controversial, but I am convinced that the first flickers of God, shall we say, although they had no word for God at that time, I'm sure, but the first flickers of God were that God was feminine. And it's only a later development that God became masculine, much to the sorrow of the world. So anyway, this is the beginning, I would say.
Barbie's mother.
Big word?
Barbie's mother.
Huh?
Barbie's mother.
Oh, Barbie's mother.
Yeah. Yeah. I read recently that even when girls play with Barbies that are dressed in work clothes, you know, they still, how did it go? They still don't have a particular desire to do that in their own life, you know, to go out and be mechanics and so forth and so on. Actually, I never wanted to be a mechanic either. But I was in the Marines for 4 years. So. Okay, begin at the beginning and go till you come to the end and then stop.
Found this recently in a magazine. Like, you're old, I'm not. You know, you're old, I'm not. So they asked a bunch of people here, people in their 40s, they asked them, at what age is a person old? Mm. I was like, okay, the people in their 40s said 63. Okay. Then they asked a bunch of people in their 50s, at what age is a person old? And the people in their 50s answered 68. A little fudging there. Hmm? Then they ask people in their 60s, when is a person old? The people in their 60s said 73. A little more fudging. Then they ask people in their 70s, when is a person old? And the people in their 70s said 75. So old, you know, is the other guy. You know, I'm 75 myself right now, but I'm not old. Or I guess I am old. Oh. I'll be letting out, Greg. Okay, a little more here. At what age is a man old? That was the question that they gave to men, and then they gave it to women. At what age is a man old? The men said 70. You know what the women said? 70. Isn't that interesting? Both the men and women said 70 was old. I don't know how old those people that they asked were, but they are obviously not 70. Then they asked the same group of people, at what age is a woman old? The men said 68. The women said 75. I agree with women. Not always, but in this case, I do.
Okay. So the little tote sheet, the yellow sheet that Todd kindly passed out, that's the cover of a booklet I've prepared, but I didn't prepare photocopies for all of you. But if you'd like a photocopy of the booklet about tote, I will be very happy to give it to you the next time I see you. So after this is all over, if you just come to me and tell me you want one, I'll put you on the list. Okay, Alice. Okay.
here's Alice, and she's peering down the hole that she's about to fall into. We're all doing that, actually. And I like it. It's very, very vivid. Really vivid. You see roots and stuff and nasty, dirty dirt. And then from the quotation here is, little Alice fell down the hole, bumped her head, but bruised her soul. See, if she bumped her head, okay, that's tough. We all bump our heads now and then. But she didn't just have to bump her head. She bruised her soul. This has made it a spiritual journey. You know, if she hadn't bruised her soul, you know, she'd gone home crying maybe, and Mama would have comforted her and so forth, but she bruised her soul. You don't easily forget that. In fact, you're not supposed to if you understand it as a journey of initiation. And then Alice in Wonderland goes on here, another quotation. Either the well was very deep or she fell very slowly, for she had plenty of time as she went down to look. She looked about her and she wondered what was going to happen next. Then it goes on. I mean, this is not exactly, you know, like this and this. I mean, these are selected quotations. At one point, Alice says, she's talking to the Cheshire Cat. We have two Cheshire Cats here, so we have no lack of conversational partners, although they're a little shy when a lot of people hear it. So Alice said to the Cheshire Cat, but I don't want to go among mad people. And the Cheshire Cat said, oh, you can't help that. We're all mad here. I'm mad. You're mad. And Alice asked, how do you know I'm mad? And the cat answered, you must be, or you wouldn't have come here. Here we are. We're all mad. So, I wanted to take a little journey together today, a little spiritual journey. And I brought a hole with me. It's important, really important to have a hole. You know, I mean, what is a hole? It's space, you know?
Right.
And this hole comes from our firewood pile. I stole it. And here's a light on the top here, the purpose of which is to show us where the hole is. You know, because how do you find a hole? I mean, the astronomers looked for, how long did they look for black holes? Is Jonathan here? No, he's not here. He can't tell us. Okay. The astronomers looked for black holes for a long, long time before they found them, you know. I mean, think about a black hole. This hole is pretty black, too. So you have to have a light to find the hole, you know. And that's what Buddhism does, you know. It's the light that shows us the hole. So we're going to... all of us, incredibly enough, will go down this hole. We're not going to fall. We're not going to fall. Okay. We're not going to fall. We're just going to go, and I'll show you how
that works. Yeah.
And so another quotation from Alice in Wonderland, which has to do with going down the hole. You know, what's our approach to going down the hole? And it says here, but I nearly forgot. I'm always doing that. But I nearly forgot. You must close your eyes. Otherwise, you won't see anything. Mm-hmm. Isn't that Zen? That is so Zen. But I nearly forgot. You must close your eyes. Otherwise, you won't see anything. What does that mean? To me, my understanding of that is that as long as we keep the rational mind in gear, we're only going to see what the rational mind wants us to see. But what we want to see is not necessarily all that. I mean, that's nice. That's very interesting what the rational mind shows us mostly. But we would like to see more. Most of us would, or certainly the people in this room would. And so paradoxically, we have to close our eyes, which means to let the rational mind, you know, let it run on and on and on as it likes to do. But don't pay attention to it. Just let it be. As we fall down the hole, except we're not falling, we're deliberately going. So in this journey down the hole, I came across, this is not from Alice in Wonderland, by the way, I came across some considerations that would be useful for us to keep in mind as we go down the hole. And this is read from this. A few considerations to accompany us on the arduous and inescapable pilgrimage into mysterious transpersonal immortality. Okay, that's kind of a mouthful, so I'll say it again. A few considerations to accompany us on the arduous, and it is indeed arduous, and but it is inescapable, ultimately, the arduous and inescapable pilgrimage into mysterious transpersonal immortality. Okay, that's core consciousness, witnessing awareness, naked awareness. In our time, we've come up with a variety of names for that, but it is our awareness which is beyond the rational mind, and which the rational mind itself can't help us get there. We have to close our eyes. Okay, so the considerations are, there's only three of them, is it possible that there is a glorious, mysterious, and freely offered transpersonal immortality so astounding it can never be completely described? Once more. Is it possible that there is a glorious, mysterious, and freely offered transpersonal immortality so astounding it can never be completely described? Next consideration. Is it possible that because transpersonal immortality is a blessing endlessly on offer to all, whatever is truly needed is never absent, even if we are convinced something is lacking? Once more. Is it possible that because transpersonal immortality is a blessing endlessly on offer to all, whatever is truly needed is never absent, even if we are convinced something is lacking? And then the last consideration, is it possible anyone can find the ultimate meaning of human existence in full surrender in a fully serving life? Is it possible anyone can find the ultimate meaning of human existence in full surrender in a fully serving life? So,
Hote is over here impatiently waiting. But
let's go down the hall.
Okay. So,
it's very simple. Everyone, take a nice deep breath, and then close your eyes. Isn't that remarkable? We all fit. I mean, I didn't even know if you guys were there.
So before we get directly into Hotea, there's something about children I'd like to say. And I have here with me, oh my God, what a bunch of stuff. I have here a cradle.
Yeah. Well, this is really a small cradle. And so, you know, this is also a symbol of the beginning, isn't it? Although, you know, these kinds of cradles are not used anymore. I wrote a poem some time ago that I think fits, not only does it fit on the bottom of the cradle, it fits in life as well. As you all know, the Buddha had, over the centuries, people gave the historical Buddha many, many titles, you know, really some titles are over the top and other titles are fantastic. And one of the titles that I like a lot is the World Honored One. And actually, the story goes that the Buddha gave himself this title just after his birth. But then I was thinking once a long time ago, well, you know, who is the World Honored One? You know, who is the World Honored One? Once, while watching the sun slowly move through the sky, I thought I must be in another world. It was almost exactly like this one, except in that other world, it was clearly understood. Birds are already angels, and children are already divine. And in that other world, everyone saw this, so they all prayed without ceasing, by cherishing all the birds and cherishing all the children all the time. You see, every baby born in our world, anytime, anywhere, any race, is indeed the World Honored One. At your birth, you were also. But tragically, no one saw that. And then you forgot too. So, in Tibetan Buddhism, here's Hotei. And he's holding high the flag of Tibetan Buddhism now that the country has been largely culturally destroyed. And they have in Tibetan Buddhism developed, or I don't know how to what the verb is, but proper verb. But they have this, what they call tukul. And the Dalai Lama, for example, is a tukul. And a tukul is a baby that the Tibetans are convinced is a profound teacher that has been reborn, that has come back to continue teaching. And as I said, this Dalai Lama and all Dalai Lamas are considered to be tukuls. This Dalai Lama was discovered, I think, when he was 3 years old. And his mother was allowed to come with him, but he moved into the monastery, or they moved him into the monastery and so forth. And I was very impressed with that. And it occurs to me that possibly, and this occurred to me a long time ago, but in the meantime, I think I've been proved right. I thought, well, tukuls could appear here in the West too. And indeed, there have been tukuls born in the West. I mean, even in the United States, for God's sake. So if they can be born here, they can be born anywhere. And then I thought, what a tragedy, because, you know, probably they're not recognized, you know. We don't have that kind of culture. We don't have that kind of insightful society. So I found a photograph of a tukul and an old monk, probably this is the tukul's tutor, his teacher, and it's probably... there's a high snowy mountain in the background, so it must be northern India. In the old days it would have been Tibet, but this doesn't happen in Tibet anymore. And and this photograph I really, really like, because the tukul is so serious. He's not playing games. He's looking at you like, I see through you, dude. You know. And his tutor, you know, who is this old monk, is bowing and holding his hand. It's incredible. Mm. And so I had to write something about this. And I wrote, in memory of all those children, both girls and boys, by the way, in Tibet, traditionally, they recognize tukul baby girls as well. Not as many as the boys, but they were there too. In memory of all these children, both girls and boys, who were born to be spiritual healers, what the Tibetans call tukuls, but failed because the society they were born into was too crude to recognize them. So that's a great tragedy. So, okay. So the beginning, they talked about start at the beginning and go until you reach the end and stop. And I have something here that demonstrates that. Okay. And we'll have to make do with this. Here it is, yeah. And then, the puzzle comes together, slowly but surely. There's a mala of skulls, from plastic, of course. Then that fits in there like that, and then that goes in there like that, that's not bad. And, this little statuette here, I apologize, my Spanish doesn't exist, but I'll do my best. This is La Santissima Muerte, Most Holy Death, is the translation here. And this is in South American countries, Mexico and so forth, very well known among us, not known at all, hardly. And then, anyway, I've written something here by way of explanation on the back here. La Santissima Muerte. Over many decades, large numbers of extremely poor Mexicans have lost hope for help from the Catholic Church. They have made La Santissima Muerte the object of their devotion in what anthropologists call a cult of crisis. I love that, cult of crisis. That's what we got going. Some of her most devoted followers appear to be prostitutes, pickpockets, petty thieves, drug traffickers, together with street people, taxi drivers, and people who live in extremely difficult or hopeless situations. She has many names, Santa Muerte being the most common. Other names are Señora de las Sombras, Lady of the Shadows, Señora Blanca, White Lady, Señora Negra, Black Lady, and Nita Santa, Holy Girl. The most common objects she carries are a scythe and a globe or a skull. The scythe can symbolize death, but also as a harvesting tool, it can stand for hope and prosperity. She is generally dressed in a long robe, which can be white, black, or red. In some of the most desperate neighborhoods of Mexico City, she is said to have more devotees than Jesus. She is probably the first saint in the history of the Catholic Church to have been created by the people themselves. So, there she is. And I added here a crucifix, which is hanging from her scythe, because I thought that this fits in with Christianity extremely well. And so I put the crucifix there.
Greg?
Yeah.
What countries again is she?
I think it's throughout South America.
Throughout South America.
But particularly in Mexico. Yeah. So, then I keep these two together, of course. And this, I think, is recognizable. It's a coffin. And this is sort of the end. I mean, most of us take it to be the end. And in some sense, indeed, it is the end. Let's see, what's on the back here? I forget. Oh, this is a wonderful... Oh, by the way, this contemplative practices sheet, I stole that from the internet, okay? I do not take credit for that. That is stolen from the internet, and I thank the internet for that. The poem is mine, indeed. And also the cover, the drawing of Fonte, I have no talent for drawing, unfortunately, no talent for drawing whatsoever. That drawing is not mine, but the other stuff on there is mine. And this poem that I want to read now is not mine. Probably some of you know it. I think it's become, deservedly so, it's become quite well known. I'm pretty sure it was written by a woman, but I don't know that. Anyway. Do not stand at my grave and weep. I am not there. I do not sleep. I am 1,000 winds that blow. I am sunlight on melting snow. I am the moon above the open plain. I am gentle autumn rain. When you awake in the morning hush, I am the soft uplifting rush of graceful birds in circling flight. I am the stars that shine each night. Do not stand at my grave and cry. I am not there. I did not die. So what dies when we die? I would say what dies is time and image. That's what dies. Time and image. Mm. Wow, released from time, released from looking good. Wow. Yeah, I can go for that. Okay. So now we can sort of slowly get into Jote. So I, about once a month, I go into San Francisco for two reasons. One, my sister lives there, and two, the Veterans Administration medical offices are there. So I have really good reasons to go there. And then I don't do it so much anymore, but in the past I used to enjoy going through Chinatown. Now it's kind of boring for me, but In the past, I went through Chinatown, and I found most of these hotels, I think, come from Chinatown in San Francisco. Yeah, I'm pretty sure. And I found these, and this is, let's see, 12. No less than 12 hotels all at once. It's kind of overdose. And so I liked it so much that it comes in it comes in a cardboard box, which is very flimsy, and so I made one of my few wood projects that went well. I made a frame for this to give it some solidity because I wanted to keep it like this. And then I added what I take to be... all of these hotels are manic-looking, actually. You know, I mean, you might in polite company, you might say they're smiling or laughing or they're happy. If you look at them longer, you'd say, well, these guys are manic, you know. It's just unreal. And so I put on here Hote, the incorrigibly happy monk and bodhisattva, who consents to appear here again and again in an astounding attempt to save billions of people from blindly believing in the twin delusions of separation and death. So, that's that. Oh, I have something to pray for. Back in the late 60s and early 70s, Buddhism hit us like a compassionate bomb. That was my experience. I mean, a few Zen teachers had already come over before that, thank God. But the Tibetan teachers started coming, and it was just really, it was a spiritual revival. I'd never been in a spiritual revival before. At the time, I didn't even know it was a spiritual revival, but I couldn't believe what was happening. It was just elated. And I wasn't even smoking anything strange. And so I thought, well, Greg, how can you support this this wonderful, wonderful change? And it occurred to me that we were going to see Buddhist-inspired kindergartens and Buddhist-inspired grade school and Buddhist-inspired high school and Buddhist-inspired universities, and the whole educational system would be positively transformed. Not that all these places would have to teach Buddhism, but there would be Buddhist inspiration. And so I thought, well, Greg, how can you support this? You're not a teacher or anything like that. And I thought, oh, finding stuff for kids that can introduce them to Buddhist ideas in a enjoyable way, you know. So I started looking around and making a little collection of stuff that I thought would be useful for introducing kids to Buddhism. And I brought a couple of those today. And let's see. There's that. Oh, yeah. Okay, let's start with this, yeah. So this is interesting, isn't it? I just love this box. It gets dirty all the time, but this box reminded me, as soon as I saw it, it reminded me of another sort of similar one. It reminded me of this. I'm sure you've all seen photos. This is a kebab, I guess, in Mecca. And I thought, my God, what a similarity, you know. Of course, this is a building. This is a three-story building, I think. This is no similarity in size. And obviously, I'm not saying spiritually that there's any equivalency whatsoever. But I was just impressed. And by the way, this photo is an enlargement from another photo that shows a much larger area of, you know, thousands of people circumambulating kebab. And this is one of the most important spiritual sites in the world, there's no doubt about it. And so anyway, I thought, you know, like, I really wondered immediately, what's inside here? You know? And so I put something inside here. And I want to show it to you. There. Huh. It's just a glass ball, that's all. Just a glass ball. But it seemed to me that this is very, very linear, you know, right? Very, very linear, and that this is unusual in nature, such a strict linearity. This is our invention, this kind of really strict linearity. And what is much more natural in nature is not necessarily balls, but curves. Most things in nature have some kind of curve or some kind of bend, or, you know, being totally straight. Bamboo, okay, but then bamboo leaves are not necessarily completely straight.
And then I thought a little bit more about this, and then I realized that,
oh yeah, the whole planet. This is, you can't see it very well, but this has the land masses of the Earth on this ball. And then I thought a little bit more about, you know, these two balls. And then I sort of recalled reading someplace that any point on a globe like this is the equivalent of any other point. You know, in other words, if we were all here on this globe, we might as well be here or here or here or here or here. It doesn't matter. It's all, every point is the equivalent of every other point on the globe. And then that connects with Buddhism for me, in that Buddhism says, this is all emptiness. What an incredible thing, you know, that we in our essence are the equivalent of not just each other, but of everything. Astounding, absolutely astounding. So, Hote. First of all, there's no proof that Hote ever really existed. I hope nobody's too disappointed, because reputable Buddhist scholars have said that the historical Buddha never really existed, and other scholars who've studied Christianity have also said that Jesus never really existed, so we shouldn't feel bad, because in some sense we don't exist either. Nobody's getting cheated. And then beyond that, to talk about Hote, there's not a lot of material, you know, written material or historical material that one can turn to. You know, Wikipedia has a decent article, but it's like one page, you know. And so it occurred to me, if I wanted to get into Hote, I'd have to do it through Hote artwork, you could say. All of these little statuettes that you find all over in Chinatown and so forth. And so I did make a collection, a very conscious collection of little artistic pieces of Hote. And the ones that have to do with his childhood, I put in this box. It's just open. Oh, yeah, there we go. So, that kind of jumbled up here, but anyway, you won't be able to see them very well. Even later on, if you're curious, you can take a look. But these are, now, I'm not saying that the Chinese artists who made these, probably they were made by machine, mass-produced, but anyway, the original artist had Hote in mind. In fact, I think he did well in one or two cases, maybe. But these are just figurines of children, of Chinese, traditional Chinese children. And for me, I interpreted them to be Hote in his childhood. For example, this one here, Hote is drinking out of a gourd. And these gourds are associated with Hote. He always has his mala. By the way, Hote's mala is here. It's a very substantial mala. And Hote usually had his sack with him, his big black Santa Claus sack, and a gourd. And I think the Chinese probably for centuries used these to carry water in. And this little figure is drinking out of a gourd. And for me, I sort of thought, well, Hote having the kind of strange adult life that he had, he probably was an orphan. And he probably had to take care of himself from a very early age. And so that's why he's shown here, you know, drinking out of a gourd, because he didn't have a family. And my childhood was rather like that as well. So, and there's a, I'll pass this around, there's a lovely little sketch of Hote here and some children playing nearby. So, we could...
Greg, could you pass that around as well?
What? Which?
The box of figurines.
The box? This? This? Yeah, oh sure. Yeah. And... But the artistic pieces concerning Hote that you can easily find, well,
actually, I didn't find him in San Francisco, so easy, but you can occasionally find is Hote with Children. And here there's one, two, three, four, five children crawling all over Hote. And this is probably what he's most famous for. As, and also a ryokan in Japan. He was a Soto monk and a wonderful poet. And also he preferred the company of children over the company of adults. And he lived largely alone until he was very, very old anyway. And according to his biography, ryokan preferred hanging out with children. And so, okay, so
like I said, there's not an awful lot that one can say, you know, based on documents about Hote.
So, I was aware of a Japanese Zen teacher, very famous in Japan, Hakuin, who lived, was born in 1689 and died in 1796, so he's, you know, fairly well-known, or extremely in Japan anyway, well-known Zen teacher, truly a remarkable monk. And a remarkable story that I want to share with you. He became the abbot of the temple in his little village, although, well, maybe it wasn't that little, but it was a village anyway. He became the abbot, and okay, fine. And then, let's see, one day, without any warning, the parents of a beautiful girl who was discovered pregnant came to Hote. No, Hote, Hakuin. the parents were very angry because of the pregnancy of this girl, their daughter, and they wanted to know who the father was, and she refused to tell them for some time, and then she finally said, well, it was Hakuin, because Hakuin was the priest, and, you know, it wasn't some, you know, young man without a job and so forth, you know. You know, Hakuin was a big deal, but on the other hand, Hakuin was a monk. And supposedly living a celibate life. So the parents of this young lady came to Hakuin and were very upset. And they, in great anger, the parents went to the master and told them this, and his reply was, is that so? You know, they said, Hakuin, you're the father of our daughter's baby, and so on and so forth. And he just said, is that so? And once the baby was born, they took it to Hakuin and said, you're the father, take care of it. So he did. And he lost his reputation, of course, completely. And that did not trouble him. But he took very good care of the child. He gave it all the milk that was necessary, that were donated by from neighbors and everything else that the child needed. And a year later, the mother of the child, she couldn't take it anymore, and so she went to her parents again and said, no, the real father is not Hakuin, it's a young man down the road, shall we say. So the mother and the father of the girl at once went to Hakuin to ask for forgiveness, to apologize at length, and to get the child back. Hakuin willingly yielded the child, saying only, is that so? Amazing. Amazing. And what also I discovered is amazing is Hakuin identified with Hote. Mm-hmm. And why do I say that? In his later life, he became one of the most famous Zen painters in Japan. And he painted many different Zen scenes, but many, many scenes of Hote. And he even painted himself as Hote. So Hakuin is somebody there's a lot to say about, and even paintings and stuff that still exist of his, I have photocopies here, a couple I'll share with you. And so when we talk about Hote, it seems like we necessarily have to talk about Hakuin also. Yeah. Time's up. Yeah. Okay. So, how can we conclude this? gracefully. That's something here. Oh, that's kind of fun. I'll leave this.